Welcome, listeners. This is Maggie reading from the Guidepost magazine with the pleasure of reading some delightful, inspiring stories for you today. So sit back and enjoy the experience. Spiritual Notebook. Connecting the dots. Her life was in upheaval. How would she ever make sense of it? By Danita Jones, Madison, Alabama. I sat in my parents' den in my mama's old chair, watching my dad wrestling with my almost 2-year-old twins. He would playfully toss one away from him, and then the other would come around and attack him from behind, giggling. It was impossible not to smile, but I was confused and angry about the string of events that had brought us here. God had some explaining to do. Less than 2 years earlier, against my better judgment and without my doctor's knowledge, I came to Alabama, where my parents lived to produce and direct a show that my production company had been commissioned to perform. I was 32 weeks pregnant with the twins, but one thing I learned working in the theater is that when opportunity knocks, you answer. My husband Paul and I already had 2 other kids, 1-year-old Lena and 5-year-old Ethan, and they came with us. We drove straight from our home in Columbus, Ohio. All the while, I was reassuring Paul that it would be a short visit. I'd do the gig, Mama and Daddy would have a chance to bond with their grandkids, and then we'd go home. I was in this very spot in the den when my water broke. 6 hours later, the twins arrived for their surprise birthday. Immediately, they were whisked off to NICU, where they stayed for the next 14 days. Paul had to go back to work, and Ethan needed to get back to school. Even after being released from the hospital, the preemies were too fragile to handle the 8-hour drive to Ohio, so I stayed with my parents' house with them and little Elena. It was a rough separation. I was running on empty, up all hours to feed the newborns while trying to maintain some sense of normalcy, making calls back and forth to Paul. How was work? And Ethan? How was school? At least my parents were able to lend a hand. Mama had been a third-grade teacher, and nobody was better with kids than she was. She never missed a chance at a teachable moment, passing along a life lesson, no matter how young you were. Ultimately, Paul and I decided to live permanently in Alabama. It seemed the best solution. There was a promise of good work from my production company. Paul would get a new job, and we'd stay with my parents for a month or two until we were able to find our own house. I wish. Paul had to take a significant pay cut at his new job. The golden opportunity for my production company collapsed, and we didn't have the means to buy a new house or even rent one. There we were, all 6 of us, stuck at my parents' house. Where was God now? Then Mama collapsed. She had heart problems, but nothing could have prepared us for what happened early one Tuesday morning. She woke up not feeling well. Daddy went out to warm up the car to take her to the hospital. He left her in the kitchen. The next thing I knew, he was calling to me. Mama had slumped over in the chair, unconscious. I called 911. The paramedics rushed in and worked on her, desperate to revive her. They thought they could hear a heartbeat, but it was just her pacemaker. She was gone. I had to do all things you do when a loved one dies, comfort my father, call my sister, let the church know, post something on social media, make the funeral arrangements, contact Mama's friends, find musicians to play for the service, make sure it was a funeral that would have made Mama proud. I might have looked as if I had everything together, but inside I was a mess. and angry, angry at God, angry that we'd have been uprooted, angry that our kids had to have a front row seat to this tragedy. I couldn't understand why so much of what we planned for, our family has fallen apart. The move, the jobs, the loss. I'd often heard people quote the Bible and say, all things work together for good to them that love God. How was any of this working for anybody's good? I rehearsed this for 100th time, sitting there in Mama's chair and watching our toddlers play with my dad. And then at once I heard her say, this is a dot, Danita. I flashed back to a particular afternoon in high school when I was upset. I'd been passed over for a part in the play. I drove over to Mama's school and found her in the classroom. I unloaded all my teenage angst. It wasn't fair. I should have gotten the part. Why me? It's just a dot, Denise, she said. What do you mean? She pulled out a sheet of paper out of her desk drawer, a worksheet with numbered dots all over it. What is this? She said, sounding just like a teacher she was. It's a dot to dot, I said, wondering what she was getting at. What's it? What is it a picture of? She asked. I don't know. I couldn't make sense of the dots. They seemed strewed all over the page in no apparent shape. That's how life is, she said. God places things in our lives, and sometimes they seem confusing or out of order. Most of the time, we have no idea why things happen the way they do. So, where are the dots? No, where are the pencil, my mother said, handing me one. The pencil never knows what the dots make up. It just goes from one dot to the next, but God sees the big picture. I stood there and began to connect the dots. In no time at all, the lines had become together to reveal a fish. What I couldn't see before had become clear. Now in my parents' den, I reconsidered what we had been through. Maybe it did make sense if I just connected the dots. My water breaking here led us to being surrounded by family to help us take care of our premature twins, which convinced us to move back home, where I could spend precious time with my mother during the last year of her life, and happened to be exactly where I was, needed when she died. Dots, all of them. Everything had seemed so random, even cruel, as it happened had come to create a larger picture leading to this moment, my father laughing for the first time in weeks as he wrestled with his grandchildren, healing from his grief. Right there in my mother's chair, I stopped viewing all of these events as blips of tragedy. I needed to trust God to reveal the beautiful, bigger picture. All things could work together in our life for good, dot to dot. Living with pain, my time of suffering. Pain is not a blessing, says this prolific religion writer, but is a way to grow closer to God. By Jonathan Merritt, New York, New York. My struggle with chronic pain began out of the blue. One gray December day, I woke up and couldn't feel my hands. I wrung my arms, shook them violently, held them under hot, then cold water. No sensation. I'm a full-time writer whose typing hands pay the rent. Panicked and bewildered, I called my doctor. Probably carpal tunnel syndrome, she said. The symptoms worsened. Prickly tingling crept up my arm and into my shoulders. The numbness became burning, aching, stabbing pain. Even my fingernails seemed to throb. Nerve twitches began in my legs, arms, back, and face. I couldn't sleep, and arose each day exhausted. I broke out in shingles. I suffered panic attacks, random stressors, a crowd, a long line, everyday occurrences in New York sent me fleeing. Increasingly desperate, I sought out help from an army of health practitioners. orthopedist, neurologist, chiropractors, nutritionists, and even Hasidic Jewish healer. My medication list grew as fast as my symptoms. Anti-inflammatories, muscle relaxants, nerve pills, painkillers, anti-epileptic drugs, sleeping pills, healthy doses of Lexapro and Xanax to stave off a nervous breakdown. I broke down anyway. Pain assailed me every moment. I woke to pain, worked with pain, dined with pain, and fought for sleep in spite of pain. My routine fell apart. My social life disintegrated. I felt tormented and alone. Even God seemed to abandon me. First I plead for help. Then I raged. Finally, still in pain, I gave up and figured God didn't care. I mostly stopped praying, stopped going to church. For a person who grew up the son of a prominent church leader and attended his first church service just 3 days after birth, I felt as if I had slammed into a sudden, cruel, inexplicable dead end. Sometimes I wish I were dead. That was 3 years ago. Today, my pain is mostly gone. My relationship with God is restored. I write, publish books, and travel to public speaking engagements as I did before. I am, you could say, healed. Or is that the right word? Certainly it's tempting to tell my story as a kind of miraculous healing. After all, that's the kind of story a person of faith might gravitate to. I see my experience differently. If there was a miracle, it was a miracle born out of struggle, despair, hard-won knowledge, and a willingness to question everything I once thought true. Pain I have learned as a teacher, a hard teacher, but sometimes a necessary one. What did I learn from pain? The answer is difficult to put into words. That's why I'm telling my story. In a way, the story is the lesson. I actually began thinking about pain as a teacher when I was at my absolute lowest point. By that time, I'd been in pain for more than a year. I was with a friend waiting in a pharmacy for yet another prescription. "Do you think God is doing this to you?" my friend asked. "I don't know," I said. "I hope not." All I knew that it feels as if the pain is some kind of teacher. I just don't know what the lesson is yet. That was the hardest part, not knowing why this was happening or how I was going to get out of it. I left the pharmacy more despondent than I ever been. A short time later, I was visiting a friend who rented a room in his apartment to vacationers. A Portuguese woman renting the room happened to overhear me talking about my misery, pretty much all I ever talked about. "The same thing happened to me," she said. "Surely not," I thought. The doctors had told me they'd never seen my array of symptoms and had no explanation. "I was told I had fibromyalgia," the woman said. "I was put on disability. I thought I'd never work again." "You're not in pain anymore," I asked. "No," she said, "and it's thanks to a doctor right here in New York. His name is John Sarno. He writes about the connection between the mind and the body. You should try one of his books." Mind? Body? What was she talking about? I looked up this Dr. Sarno. He began treating patients for back pain in the 1970s. He knows that there was often no correlation between patients' symptoms and the physical conditions of their back. Some had pain, but no underlying physical problem. Others had slipped discs and other abnormalities, but little pain. One thing many of the patients did have in common, huge amount of stress, an unresolved emotional conflict. Sarno concluded that, at least in some cases, chronic pain can be caused by more than physical symptoms. Resolving problems in the mind sometimes resolves problems in the body. I was raised in a very traditional conservative wing of the church. Growing up, I was taught that when bad things happen to people, it's often because they did something wrong and God is punishing them. I was also taught that only crazy non-believers seek psychological therapy or any other non-traditional form of healing. Faith and prayer are all you need, I was told. Dr. Sarno sounded like someone I would have been warned away from. Well, I was desperate. I read one of his books. It felt like my autobiography. I made an appointment with one of his proteges. He diagnosed me with chronic pain stemming from unresolved psychological conflict. He recommended I see a therapist and reduce stress in my life. Still skeptical, still desperate, I saw the therapist. To my surprise, I found myself weeping in her office and talking about all sorts of things that seemed to have nothing to do with the numbness in my hands or my inability to sleep, or the pain that tortured me every day. Over the course of many months, I told the therapist about the strictness of my upbringing, about the idea I absorbed that God is mercurial and wrathful, loving only those people who are perfect and follow the rules. I told about the older boy in my neighborhood who sexually abused me. I told about my struggle with intimacy. The more I told, the more I began to see not only how much psychological pain had built up inside me over the years, but also how frightened I was that maybe the pain was punishment from God or a sign that I was doing something wrong. Or, worst of all, a sign that God didn't care and had turned his back on me. The therapist recommended meditation to help reorientate my nervous system. Your brain is using physical pain as a way of coping with your deep emotional pain, she said. Meditation was another thing I'd been warned away from while growing up. With the help of more reading, I realized Christians have been practicing a form of meditation for centuries. It's called contemplative prayer, sitting quietly in God's presence rather than coming to Him with a laundry list of requests. I tried it. It felt strange at first, a bit boring and frustrating. Thoughts and fears clamored noisily as I sat. The more I did it, the more the clamor fell away, and I felt myself surrounded by something I had never experienced before. A loving presence larger than my fretful mind, larger than my pain, larger than everything. Last fall, I decided it was time to try putting all this treatment to the test. I flushed the remaining pain medication I was taking down the toilet. A friend who owned a house in the country offered to let me stay there for a month. There was no cell phone reception, no TV, nothing to distract me. I spent my days reading, walking, writing, and sitting in prayer. I thought about everything the therapist had told me. I dove into a painful experience in my life, reimagining them as if I had not been helpless. I sat quietly with the Lord. I was just beginning to know. Who was this God? He was a God of love, not wrath, a God who did not demand perfection, a God who did not give up on me, and never turned his back on anyone. A God who always kept this central, defining promise to humanity, I am here. When I returned to the city, my pain was almost entirely gone. I was psychologically and emotionally wrung out. I had never felt more alive. I didn't tell this story because I think all chronic pain is like mine. According to the Centers for Disease Control, up to 4 in 10 Americans suffer from some sort of chronic pain, and every one of these people has a story that's unique. The American medical system excels at treating conditions that can be tested, scanned, and cured with drugs or surgery. Sometimes such treatment is necessary. Sometimes it's worth exploring further. The mind, the body, and the soul are closely intertwined. God is not a specialist. God sees, loves, and is present with the whole person. I hope I never have to take pain, challenging classes again. It was the most frightening, debilitating experience of my life. And yet, as I gained my health, I am grateful for what I learned. I learned how to pray again. I learned that, like everyone else, I experienced hard things growing up, but that those things do not have to rule my life today. I learned to accept myself as I am, and that I don't have to be perfect to be loved. God is perfect, not me. And God, I learned the most important lesson of all, is always there, always loving, always beside me. Doubtless I will know pain again as I get older. I am already for it now. Walking with God, I know I will not be alone. And so I will not be afraid. How to find your inner warrior. When facing big challenges, we tend to focus on our limitations, not our strengths. God doesn't see it that way. By Pablo Diaz. How to find your inner warrior. When facing big challenges, we tend to focus on our limitations, not our strengths. God doesn't see it that way. By Pablo Diaz. Do you focus on your strengths or on your limitations? The answer is crucial in achieving our goals and succeeding on our own terms. We should not ignore our limitations, as there is always room for improvement. But when we push past our shortcomings and focus on our strengths, we can accomplish much more in our lives. There is a story in the Bible about Gideon, a man who focused solely on his weakness instead of on the opportunity he was granted by God, and he came close to missing his life's calling. Gideon wasn't a king nor a prophet, but a hard-working farmer who lived in a time of great distress, oppression and oppression for the people of God. One day, Gideon was going about his business as usual when an angel appeared to him with a message from God asking him to save the people from their enemies. The angel saw him as a mighty warrior, but Gideon couldn't see past his own limitations. Gideon wasn't able to see his capacity of leading his people to victory. He told the angel that his family was the weakest of the tribe and he the least of the family. He allowed these social labels to define his ability to fulfill the mission bestowed on him. His energy was focused on perceived constraints instead of what he was capable of actually doing. He didn't see himself as a mighty warrior, but as a defeated farmer. How we see ourselves is very different than how God sees us. Gideon went back and forth with the angel before he was able to accept that he was indeed a mighty warrior. Have you ever felt unqualified for a new work assignment or a leadership position? I have on many occasions. God sees our great capacity, talents, and potential to do amazing things. Gideon's story shows us that we must shift our focus from our limitations, real or perceived, to our strengths in order to succeed. Gideon responded to his calling as a mighty warrior with a small army and won the war. We mustn't let past failures, negative family history, and personal struggles define our fate and success. As Coach John Wooden would say, do not let what you cannot do interfere with what you can do. Believe you have what it takes, and with God's help, all things are possible. Our story can make a difference. Princely inspiration. I became a fan of the musician Prince as a rebellious teen in the 1980s. The fact that my parents disapproved of this music made him all the more appealing. In 2016, my husband, kids, and I moved to Chanhassen, the Minneapolis suburb that's home to Prince's compound, Paisley Park. Just 1 month later, Prince died. Afterward, I heard his songs anew. Purple Rain became about a redemptive power of God. Diamonds and Pearls sounded like God talking to Prince. And because carrying doves are a sign of things changing from bad to good, could When Doves Cry be a message of hope? I since learned all kinds of surprising information about Prince. He's written songs about faith and positivity, such as Love, Thy Will Be Done, and I Wish You Heaven. He was a regular around the town, shopping at the hardware store and going to the grocery for cherry pie. I found out that Prince was also a longtime Guidepost subscriber. The more I thought about it, the more it made sense. Prince was a lifelong seeker of spiritual nourishment. Why wouldn't Guidepost stories be as meaningful to him as they are to the rest of us? I decided to try to be more like Prince, to work hard until something is finished, the way he kept going until a song was done, to share my gifts and encourage others to share their way, to share theirs, the way Prince constantly found and promoted new musicians, to be a good neighbor, the way he opened Paisley Park to locals for impromptu concerts and dance parties, getting to know more about a man behind the flamboyant costumes and sometimes edgy lyrics taught me something else, to not be so quick to judge. We are all vessels of God.